mind body category difference. What I mean is these actual differences are taken and they're mapped onto a person's existence. They're mapped onto their body and they become closely identified with that person. And so they're considered to be a part fundamentally of who or what that person is. And so the fact that, again, this is seen in the writings of Puritans about Roman Catholics, the language that they use, for lack of a better word, oftentimes is very racist. I mean, their Catholicism is something that's an integral part of who they are. They can't be who they are without it. And they're considered inferior, and this difference is mapped onto their body. And so it's a constructed aspect of identity. And by that, this constructed aspect of identity, by that, what I mean is these real differences are applied to them to make meaning of who they are and what they are. So it's an idea of making meaning and creating an identity. A couple things that race isn't. It's not imposed by one group upon another, and it's not a construction by one group of its own identity in opposition to the other. Really all I'm saying there is that it's dialectical. That's just a word we use when we're talking about things going both ways, and we'd have no other better word to use. I mean, it's a dialogue. It's something that's taking place, and you need at least two groups for it to happen. One group can't create their own racial identity. They can create identities, but they can't form identities about themselves without some sort of interaction with other groups. And so the sort of statement that I'd like to sort of guide, so you can see what I'm trying to say as we're thinking about this idea of average and race today, sort of guide your thoughts and know what I'm getting at, is that race is a product of ongoing dialogue between dominated and subordinated peoples. And it's ongoing because in colonial New England, this is so clear, race as a category is very flexible. It changes sometimes within the minutes, within hours. Native Americans initially are thought of as described as red, or they're described as tawny. They're described as Indians. And that's okay as long as when we're thinking about slavery, they're enslaved, they can be enslaved as Indians, as red people. By the mid-17th century, late 17th century, not only is it becoming illegal to enslave Indians, but it's just not working on some practical levels, and they're able to escape and they're able to work together and hide each other in ways that Africans can't. And so, by and large, it becomes unfashionable to enslave Indians. So at that point, rather than describing Indians as red, once it's illegal and unfashionable to enslave them, Indians, people who are definitely Indian, because in recent censuses they've been counted that way, now show up as black or as West Indian. The identity, the racial identity that's assigned to them changes with the times. And so that's why I would say it's a product of ongoing dialogue. This idea of race changes throughout colonial New England. And this isn't, it's also the notion of a dialogue and this dialectical component is important, because not only can whites use this to their advantage, but Indians can as well, or blacks can as well, particularly Indians. I mean, they become masterful in doing this. They know that if I'm identified as an Indian, I can't be enslaved anymore, and so they'll go to court to prove they're an Indian, or to prove they have rights to particular land. I'm not black, I'm Indian, so this land is mine. And so this notion of a dialogue, this dialectical component, is really important, because usually when we think of race, we think of it as sort of this power tool that's used by the dominant group over the subordinate group, but, and it's happened in other periods as well, but certainly in colonial America, the subordinate group used the notion of race to their advantage as well, and they use its flexibility to their advantage. Okay, so a lot of confusing, convoluted stuff. I understand. Okay, but how did Edwards understand human differences? I think this is one of the ways he understood it, and hopefully through the rest of our time we get to see that. Second question, though, in this sort of contextual setting of Edwards struggling to make sense of others, is what prompted him to make such sense of others? What was going on in his world that made him have to participate in this ongoing dialogue between dominated and subordinated peoples? Well, the main thing, I think, and sort of the place for us to move quickly through, is the changing world of colonial New England. Beginning in the 17th century and in the 16th century, when settlement and colonization and exploration of what becomes the northern colonies is just beginning, the population of New England were people that looked like this. They were Indians. Like, you know, this picture of John White's portrait of the wife of Pomeok and her daughter. And the majority of people at the beginning of the 17th century who lived in the northern, what would become the northern colonies, were Native American. 1620, as the pilgrims begin to settle, and definitely by 1630, when John Winthrop begins the great migration period of English colonists to the northern colonies, the population rapidly begins to look like this. Well, maybe not the collar, but they begin to look like this. And in the meantime, in the mid-1620s, as early as 1624, there's a third group of people that are making up the changing world colony of New England. And it's people that look like this. Africans who are forcibly removed from Africa and brought to the ports of Boston and to Newport and to New London, Connecticut. And oftentimes these are the people who aren't healthy enough to work in the West Indies or to work in the Southern colonies. So they're sort of the refuse, if you would, of the slave trade. And they're brought to the colony of New England. They're making up this population as well. So you got these three groups living together, and they're living near each other. They're interacting with each other on a daily basis. And so, as I say, necessity is the mother of invention. By necessity, they have to begin to think about each other and make sense of where these other groups and where they fit in this new society that they're creating. And what Winthrop calls in his sermon on the model of Christian charity, a city on a hill. They've got to determine where they live and how they make sense of each other. So the changing world colony of New England, if you got the outlines off the web or if you get the handouts earlier, so we can move through this fairly quickly. First thing I want to sort of point out about the changing world colony of New England is the change in the population of white New Englanders. Again, as you're able to look back at the notes that you get from the web, I mean, the general thing is to see that there's a rapid increase beginning in the 1620s through the time of the Revolution in the population of white New Englanders. I mean, in this small area where, you know, if you're in Providence, Rhode Island, if you drive an hour, you can get to just about anywhere in colonial New England. I mean, so, you know, this rapid increase of the white population. The white population, though, isn't the only population that's increasing rapidly. Black New Englanders throughout the colonial period, particularly most of the estimates don't begin counting them until the 18th century, but the guesstimates and estimates that are given in letters and some early census information shows a similar increase, though not as rapid as whites, but a similar increase in the black population. And for each of these figures, again, these numbers are online, but for each of these figures, I mean, the last number that I give, you're noticing the percentages, the total percentage of the total population of that colony. So by the 1760s in Massachusetts, just over 2% of the population is black. Rhode Island, 1755, almost 12% of the population is African. In the Narragansett region of Rhode Island, there were quite a few plantations, and that's why the Africans were there. Now, the Connecticut population is a little larger as well, because there were some tobacco plantations in western Connecticut. So the Africans are being brought there. But by and large, most of these slaves are serving as, they're living in and among family units. They're serving as domestic help. While it's not as dramatic as the white population, the thing I want you to see is that during the colonial period, the black population in New England is growing fairly rapidly as well. So the black population is growing, the white population is growing, but as you notice from the statistics on the web and here, in general, the Indian population is declining. Numbers are a little deceptive, in part because most of the numbers that we have are from the 18th century. So in the heyday, when there actually were a large number of Indians living in the colonies, say in the early 17th century, 1620s, 1630s, as English colonization begins, the number would have been much higher. Most of these numbers, with the exception, well, even with New Hampshire, most of these numbers, as we're going to see in a moment, are given after the deadliest of the Indian Wars have taken place, the deadliest epidemics have taken place. So these numbers are somewhat skewed, but in general, the thing I want you to see is that there is a rather rapid decline of the Indian population over this same period. So while the black population is growing and the white population in colonial New England is growing, the Indian population is declining fairly rapidly. Again, hard to be certain how rapidly, and also one reason it's hard to be certain how rapidly, other than the fact that it's hard to know how many were there in 1620, it's also hard to tell how accurate these numbers are because of what I mentioned a moment ago, the flexibility of being an Indian. I mean, most of these numbers are coming from estimates from censuses and tax reports. If you're being taxed for owning an African, the African may be counted as an Indian. If you're, because of the flexibility of their identities, their racial identities. If you're keeping an Indian as a slave, and it's illegal to do so, you're going to count them as an African. They're going to show up under the numbers of Negro slaves in the census reports. So, again, the numbers are somewhat deceptive, but in general, what I want you to notice is that except for Rhode Island, where Roger Williams worked, and where after the Indian Wars, many of the surviving Indians are sort of corralled on a couple of islands, except for Rhode Island, most of the general population of Indians is declining. So the changes, three changes I think that help us understand the decrease of the Indian population, we move quickly through those, and then one change and cause that I think helps explain the growth in the white and African population. So for the decrease of Native Americans, again, these three reasons or causes help influence these changes and help bring these changes about. And for the increase of whites and Africans, it has to do with labor, primarily. So disease, displacement, and warfare, labor. Under disease, two diseases in particular that are mentioned in your notes, and if you're able to get those, you'll see some of the statements that the Puritans make as they're evaluating these diseases. The first is the plague of 1616 and 1619. Scholars aren't really sure what this plague was, whether it was smallpox, measles, the bubonic plague, yellow fever. Not certain, but what we do know is that when the Pilgrims arrived in 1620, having heard reports of some of the propaganda literature about the need to migrate, having heard reports of how many Indians were there, they arrive in the New World expecting to see the countryside just teeming with Indians. And they don't find that, so it's really a surprise. And so Thomas Morton, when he writes 20 years later about this plague of 1616 and 1619, describes some of the devastating effects of it, and that Indians are, our Native Americans just are lying in heaps, and the people who are surviving and who escaped the epidemic are leaving them there and picking up the stakes and the tents, and they're taking off. They don't want to be a part of this plague. They don't understand it. They don't know what's going on. They just see people dying all around them. Second disease to think briefly about is the smallpox epidemic shortly after the Great Migration begins. So 13 or 14 years after the English arrive in the New World, smallpox ravages the Native American population. And John Winthrop describes that in his journal, John Winthrop, the first governor Massachusetts Bay, and longtime governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, describes in his journals going as far as any Indian population was known. And so, weakened by the plague of 1616 and 1619, the smallpox epidemic hits and again begins to wipe out the Indian population. So, a couple of diseases. Other diseases, whether it's dysentery, simple common colds that kill the Indians because they don't have their immune systems are efficient and aren't able to combat these virgin soil epidemics, just wipe out Indian populations. So the world's changing rapidly. Indians are dying because of disease. The world's also changing colonialism because of displacement. Here we're talking particularly about removal from land. Don't have a lot of time to talk about the three sort of instances that I've included. This notion of Nenegret, Rhode Island, is a series of court cases where English colonists take advantage of confusion among the Indians of who the right leader was. And they take advantage of that so that they're able to get this land and have it for themselves. And great discussion of this in Anne-Marie Plain's book, Colonial Intimacies, or a recent book by John Wood Sweet called Bodies Politic. They deal really brilliantly with what's going on in Nenegret, Rhode Island. Father Rail's War, similar thing. This is occurring in Maine in the 1720s. Puritans are concerned with the fact that Father Rail, Catholic leader, is converting many of the Indians in the region to Catholicism, and so they want to get rid of Father Rail. And in getting rid of Father Rail, they're able to get the Indian land. So it's a religious war in many respects, but they're able to benefit from it as far as land goes as well. And then there are most of the instances of displacement among Indians were completely legal. Indians who either didn't own the land or didn't really know what they were doing when they signed these properties rights away. They didn't understand property perhaps in the exact same way as the Europeans and the English did. And so in a very legal manner, they allow themselves to be displaced from the land and push further and further west until we see them on mission grounds, you know, like Edwards works in 1750s in Stockbridge. One thing that's interesting, and we begin to see this, we're going to see this in the discussion of Edwards in particular, but here in this notion of displacement, we see it with disease as well, I think this is fascinating, is the way Puritans justify removing Indians from their land. Again, we don't have time to look at all these quotes, but they are on the web in the notes. But in general, the New England Puritans are very adept at appealing to theology to make sense of social realities. And so when they see these Indians dying from sickness, or they see their land being taken away and they're pushed further and further west, one of the ways they explain it is by appealing to the sovereignty of God. And that's something that to them is very real and is a tangible idea, something that matters and they're able to construct their lives around. And so when these things happen, rather than even questioning whether or not what they're doing is right, they fall back on this adeptness that they have within their theological system to make sense of social realities, and I would argue, and will in a few moments, to make sense of human differences, this adeptness of relying on their theology. We have disease, we have displacement, those things are contributing to the change in the Indian population and indeed to the decline of it. Also, we have wars, and then very briefly, two wars that are really important in getting rid of the remaining Indians that are there, wiping out a couple of tribes, and all but erasing them from the colonial landscape. First, the Pequot War. In 1634, a group of Indians killed John Stone. John Stone was a traitor. He really wasn't a nice guy. And the English probably wouldn't have cared that he was dead, except Indians killed him. Now, why did they kill him? Well, they killed him because he had kidnapped them, hoping to get a ransom. And so they retaliated and killed him. This didn't make the English happy. 2 years later, another traitor, and fur trader, John Oldham, is killed. And at this point, Puritans have had enough. So later that year, John Endicott leads a colonial force against the Pequots and the Narragansetts. This is the Narragansett region of Rhode Island, and the Pequots live in this region here. So a force is led by John Endicott against these two Indian tribes. They attack a village, and this first attempt is a complete failure. The Indians fight only long enough to get away. So all these Puritan soldiers who've been promised wampum and different plunder, they end up getting nothing. Less than a year later, however, John Mason leads an expedition against Mystic Village, which is located here on the map. At the time, Mystic Village contained somewhere between 300 and 700 Indians. So John Mason leads a united force of Puritan soldiers, and people from Massachusetts and Connecticut, and Mohegan Indians, which in some respect and some connection to the Mohawks and the Mohicans that Edwards works with in Stockbridge. John Mason leads them in an expedition, a strike against the Pequot village at Mystic. Really famous image, woodcutting of the attack. In the center here, you have the Indian village. The outside, you have the English and Puritan forces. And outside of them, you have the Indian forces, the Mohicans on the outside to kill any people who happen to break through this first line. And you can see the image in the first line, the English soldiers have torches in their hand. And what they did was they burned the village to the ground. Of the 300 to 700 people that were there, most of them were women, children, and old men. The warriors were up in a different camp. So the Puritans attacked this village. Seven people escaped. Of those who escaped and the warriors and other Pequots and Narragansetts who weren't in Mystic, over the next few months, they're hunted down. This time the men are killed, the women children and old men aren't killed, but they're sold into slavery, either in the colonies or in the West Indies. By the end of this war, the Pequot tribe is all but non-existent. There's still a small remnant today in southern Connecticut, southeastern Connecticut, and southwestern Rhode Island, but for the most part, by the end of this war, they're gone. The other sort of major war that occurs a generation later is King Philip's War, 75 to 76. Again, so move quickly through this. There's a great discussion of this in a book by Jill Lepore called The Name of War. It's a wonderful book on King Philip's War. King Philip's War is named that because of Metacom, who probably remember this from your high school and college history, but Metacom, his English name was Philip. He was the leader of the Wampanoags. John Sassaman is killed, and this is one of the causes for the war. John Sassaman was an Indian who served as an ambassador for the English. He was one of the few people in the Wampanoag tribe who could read. In making some treaties, he apparently wrote the treaty in such a way that benefited him, and Metacom finds out, and apparently, possibly, supposedly, allegedly, has Sassaman killed. Spring rolls around, and his body dumped in a pond. Spring rolls around, the ice melts, and they find Sassaman's body. Metacom and the people that are his forces who supposedly killed Sassaman are brought to court. And, long play of events leads to the war. There are also some issues with land claims. One of the interesting things about this, again, is to notice a Puritan, John Talcott, who was a leader of some of the forces, again, turning to theology to make sense of social realities. Kill and destroy them according to the utmost power of God shall give you. In other language that Mather and others use to describe this war, I mean, it's very clear they see the Indians as the forces of Satan. The war ends with the death of Metacom. Thousands of Indians are killed. Thousands of Wampanoags are killed. And similar to the Pequot War, by the end of the war, most of the Wampanoag tribe has been erased. Those who aren't killed are sold into slavery, again, in the colonies. Most of them, though, now at this point, go to the West Indies. One of the people who sold into slavery is Metacom's 9-year-old son, and there's this great court case and this battle between Puritan leaders in Boston trying to decide what to do with Metacom's son. I mean, he's 9 years old, which is killing because he's the son of, you know, this guy who's already been killed. So, Metacom's sin is falling on the son, or should we just sell him into slavery and spare his life? And this argument goes on for weeks, what to do with this kid whose name they don't even know. But in general, you know, thousands of Indians die. The Wampanoags are all but erased, and those who do survive are sold into slavery, primarily this time in the West Indies. It's already becoming unfashionable to have Indians as slaves. So the Indian population is changing and declining in large part because for those two reasons: disease, displacement, and warfare. The white and black population, on the other hand, is increasing in large part because of labor. If the colony is going to be a commercial success or a success of any nature, there's got to be some sort of people that are working. There's got to be labor involved. So you've got to have tradesmen. You've got to have artisans. You've got to have a blacksmith. You have to have someone to help, you know, whatever food you're not raising for yourself. So labor is essential. The first form of labor that really contributes to the growth, in this case, of the white population, is indentured servitude. This is a copy of the indenture contract that was signed. Indenture contract usually contains three things. It contains a term of service. At this point, usually about 7 years, an English person would sign their labor away to someone else for 7 years. And there were promises of service. I mean, they promised to do this for this amount of time. And they would do it because of what they would receive in return. The most important thing initially is the Great Migration begins. So in the early 17th century, 1630s, 1640s, they received passage to the New World, which opened up opportunities they didn't have in England. What main opportunity being the opportunity eventually to get land. They received board, room and board once they were in the New World. They received clothing, they received food. If they survived to the end of their service, there was generally an inclusion of freedom dues, the things that would be given to them at the end of their term of service, whether it's tools to carry out their trade, land, money, usually at least a fresh suit of clothes.